Want to speak about something that is relevant to Yom Kippur and these last few days before Yom Kippur. I'm sure that at some point in the past I've spoken about this, but Yom Kippur also we've had in the past, and the same Yom Kippur with the same Machzor, and it's kedai to review. The Gemara says that on Rosh Hashanah, Kol boy olam ovrim lefanov kivnei moron. On Rosh Hashanah, all human beings pass before God kibnei moron. We'll discuss in 1 second what that means. And that, in my estimation, will be a means for us to discover what it is that God is judging us on. And since we have to assume that we are Beinonim, I probably assume that all of you are Tzaddikim, but I know that I'm at least a Beinoni. So our judgment isn't over yet. The judgment continues till Yom Kippur. So we are still in the midst of that judgment, and it won't be sealed and completed till Ne'ilah of Yom Kippur. So it would be a good idea for us to understand what God is judging us on, what he's interested, what he's looking for, so we know what to present him with, what to think about, and what to, by the time Yom Kippur comes, make the proper commitments and changes if necessary or whatever. So the rabbis explained that Mishnah that we pass before him, Kibnei Moron, with three different opinions. The first opinion, Bnei Moron, comes from the Imarna, Bnei Imarna. Imarna in Aramaic means sheep, meaning we pass before God like sheep pass before the shepherd. And we say that in Rosh Hashanah, Kivakoras roe edro, mavir sono tachashifto, as the shepherd passes his sheep before him, single file, one by one, passes under the rod, so too we pass before God, single file, one by one, to be judged. That is the first opinion. The second opinion, what Bnei Moron means, Kima'alos Beit Choron, like the steep mountain pass that was composed of steps that were very, very narrow, where you could only ascend that mountain single file, one at a time. And the Gemara says Beit Moron, but most of the versions are Beit Choron. Beit Choron is on the way between here and where I live, and it's a steep mountain, and they used to have a staircase that went up the mountain, a single file staircase. A lot of the wars of the Maccabees took place there. In any case, so that's the second opinion, meaning just like these people go up this staircase single file, we pass before God also single file. Third opinion, Kehumarna de Malka, like the authority of the king. Just like the king reviews his troops, reviews the soldiers, they pass before him one by one, and he reviews them, so too on Rosh Hashanah we pass before God in single file, one by one, like soldiers passing before the king. Bottom line, they all say the same thing. We pass by single file, one by one, to be scrutinized by God. There must be something more to the analogies than just the fact that they're single file. Otherwise, what difference does it make if we're passing like sheep, like climbers, or like soldiers? So there are other explanations to this Gemara, but I'm going to tell you what I think. And what I think is the following. Each of these analogies reveals another aspect of the judgment. They are not contradictory. They are all aspects that together tell us the full picture. We are being judged on three different aspects, like sheep, like climbers, like soldiers. And now let me explain what each one is. Why does a shepherd pass his sheep before him? Basically, he wants to see the following things. Number one, he wants to see if they're there. He wants to count them. See that they didn't die, they didn't run away. He wants to make sure that his entire flock is there. So he counts every sheep. Secondly, even if they're there, He wants to see if they're healthy. Maybe they're blemished. Maybe they're sick. Maybe there's something that is missing by them, something wrong with them. So he wants to inspect them and see if they're healthy, and if not, what's wrong. And lastly, he wants to inspect them and make sure that each one bears his brand, so you know whose sheep it is. Every sheep has the brand, the mark of that specific owner. And the shepherd checks each of his sheep to make sure they're his sheep, that people know that they're his sheep. How does that translate to our judgment? God first wants to see if we're still there, if we're part of his flock, if we haven't turned our backs on him completely, if we haven't gone off the derech since last year. Okay, that's one possibility. Even if we're there and we haven't rebelled against him or gone off the derech completely, how healthy are we? How do our mitzvahs look? Are they healthy mitzvahs? Are we doing sins that make us blemished? How do our character traits, our behavior between man and man, how is that? What kind of personalities do we have? What kind of character traits do we have? What kind of beliefs do we have? How strong are we in what we believe? Do we have doubts? And don't get worried, everybody has doubts. But how strong are those doubts? How do we deal with them? So we are going to be judged in this first aspect of judgment on all our mitzvahs, all of our beliefs, all of our character and personality traits, and how we actually functioned in the past year in all of these areas. And there's still one more thing in this first aspect. And that is, do we bear God's brand? And we've spoken about this in detail at many occasions, so I'm not going to go into great detail. I'm just going to mention something I don't remember if I ever mentioned before, an example, a story. But it's not enough just to keep 613 mitzvahs. I mean, halavai, we should do that, and that's very nice, and I'm not trying to minimize the importance of that. But it doesn't end there. There's more to Yiddishkeit than just keeping a bunch of rules. It's not a Milton Bradley game that if you keep the rules, you pass go, you go to Olam Haba and collect your $200. It's not what it's all about. We have a responsibility to be a mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh, a nation of priests, and a holy nation. A kohen is God's representative to the world. We represent God to the world. And how do we do that? We don't go around handing out his calling card. I represent God. If you need him, here's my number. What we do is we live a holy life. We live a life that is godly. That's what a Jew has to do. The way he eats, the way he drinks, the way he conducts his married life and social life and business life have to be more than moral, godly. Godly. What does that mean? That doesn't mean sitting in a corner and saying Tehillim all day. It means in every aspect of life, doing it in a way that when people see it, they say, that's holy. There must be a God in this world because that's a godly way of acting. I don't remember how recently we mentioned this, but I'm going to mention it because it's the only thing that comes to mind of an example. In the Boston area, it must have been about 10 years ago, there was a man, and I think he's still alive, and he should remain alive for many years. His name was Feuerstein. We spoke about Aaron Feuerstein, okay. He owned a mill, a textile mill. Well, very, very big textile mill, very wealthy man, and his mill burnt down. Now, he had tens, if not hundreds of workers working for him, and what was expected, what anybody would have done, and 100% morally, he would have laid off all these workers until he rebuilt his mill. Because he doesn't have a mill. He doesn't have any work for these people. And they would have lost their medical benefits and who knows what else. So instead of laying off these people, he kept them on the payroll. Not that he paid them. I mean, that's obviously impossible. But he kept up their medical benefits. He kept up their Social Security. All through the many months that he didn't have a business. Until he rebuilt his business. Because he felt, not necessarily a moral obligation, but he felt an obligation to these people. Now this man is a frumayid, an Orthodox Jew. And every newspaper and magazine, Time Magazine and the New York Times, every major publication in America picked up this story and reported it.
And the Reader's Digest.
Okay. This was a Kiddush Hashem. That's what it means that a Jew has to live a godly life. That's a Kiddush Hashem. That's functioning not just as a moral person, that's functioning as a godly person. And that's a Kiddush Hashem. So we have a responsibility to bear God's brand. It's not enough just to keep a bunch of mitzvahs, but to have the same secular lifestyle and goals and values as the secular world. And you can do that. Before Pesach, when I was in Miami, inevitably, many people came to me with ads from the Jewish press for cruises to the Bahamas for Pesach. And they wanted me to check it out and see if it was okay, kashrus-wise, Shabbos, Yontif, or whatever. And I always had this problem with it, that true, maybe from the four halakim of Shulchan Aruch, there's nothing wrong with these cruises. But is that really what God intended when he gave us Zman Cherusenu? You should be on a boat going to on a cruise to the Bahamas, right, for Pesach? Again, if these people needed a vacation and they needed fresh air, but they had more fresh air in their backyards in Miami than on the boat, and they didn't get seasick. So why did they do it? Many of them, because it was a status symbol, right? That's what, you know, a goy, you know, take a cruise to the Bahamas, that's something special. So they wanted to have that same feeling, but they had to do it glatt kosher. So what did that leave them? Being glatt kosher goyim, but not glatt kosher Jews. It's the same standards and the same values and the same lifestyle as the goy, except you do it glatt kosher. You do it glatt kosher. I think I've told this other story many times here, but when I was a rabbi in Miami, my first year or two there, even after that, the community was about 150 families, most of them frum, but it was just getting started. We didn't have a mikveh in the community. We didn't have a yeshiva in the community. The closest mikveh was 20 minutes away by car in Miami Beach. We couldn't go Shabbos and Yom Tov to the mikveh. So once an influential and wealthy balabos of mine came to me very upset one day. He said, "I must speak to you immediately." Comes into my office. He says, "Rabbi, there's something that's been bothering me for a while. I got to get it off my chest. There is one thing that this community is missing that would make it a top-notch Torah community, and I'm really upset that we don't have it." So I thought he was talking either about a mikveh or about a yeshiva. And when he would tell me which one it was, I would tell him, "Well, if you're so upset that we don't have a mikveh, why don't you become the chairman of the mikveh committee and help build one?" So with bated breath, I said to him, "What is that one thing that this community is missing that would make it a top-notch Torah community?" And he said, "A first-rate, glatt kosher French restaurant." After I regained consciousness, trying to figure out where the mikveh is going to fit in this restaurant, I assessed the situation. Don't get me wrong. There is nothing wrong with French food, with glatt kosher French restaurants. Nothing wrong with it. Right, my expertise in French cuisine ends with French fries. But I'm sure there's more to it, okay? I'm sure there's much more to it, okay? And nothing wrong with that. But what in the world does it have to do with being a top-notch Torah community? Top-notch French community, top-notch food community. What does that have to do with Torah? I must have missed those classes and tells when they spoke about French restaurants. Right? I don't remember that being part of the curriculum. What in the world does being a top-notch Torah community have to do with having a first-rate French restaurant, glatt kosher? Elamai, you have the same standards and values and lifestyle as the goy. In a goy's mind, a secular person's mind, what's a community? What kind of eating establishments you have? What kind of cultural establishments you have? And that's what makes a community. So you just take your goyish secular ideas and goals and standards and values and lifestyle, and you make it glatt kosher. If it's glatt kosher, it's okay. But you remain a glatt kosher goy. That's not what the Rebbe Mishlam wants, ultimately. Not to minimize the fact that somebody who keeps tarjik mitzvahs, even that way, all the credit to him. But there's something missing. So the Rebbe Mishlam is not only going to judge us on how many mitzvahs we did and how well we did them and what kind of personalities and characters we have and what kind of beliefs we have. He's also going to judge us on our lifestyle. Do you have my brand? Do you represent me? Are you a sheep in my flock? Is it obvious that you are a sheep in my flock or not? That is the first aspect of judgment. Now, it sounds like there's nothing left. What else could God be judging us for? So let me tell you what. Comes the second. That's like sheep. Now comes the people climbing up the mountain. Two people could be on the exact same level as sheep. Let's say both on level 30. They have the same mitzvahs, the same averas, the same lifestyle, exactly the same. One will get a good judgment, and one will get a negative judgment. How could it be? The answer is very simple. They're both on level 30. But last year, person A was on level 40. He's regressed 10 steps to level 30 over the year. The other person was on level 20 last year. He's progressed 10 levels to level 30. Can't you see that person A is going to get a bad judgment and person B is going to get a good judgment, even though they're in the exact same place? So God is not only concerned, are we good sheep, where we are now. He wants to know, where were you before and where are you now vis-a-vis that? Are you progressing? Are you regressing? Or are you stagnating, which is also pretty bad because you can't stagnate. Stagnation in this world of movement means you're going back down. Like I always say, this world is like a down escalator that you're trying to go up. You stand still, you go down. You make an effort, you may stand still. You make a big effort, you may get a little bit ahead. But if you stand still, you go down. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to judge us like people climbing up the mountain. How far have you progressed? How much have you regressed? I don't only care where you are now. I want to know where you were, where you're coming from, and where you're going to. So God is going to judge us not only as sheep, he's going to judge us as climbers also. Whenever you speak to a living person, you say Lech Lishalom. When you bid farewell to somebody who's passed away at a levaya, you say Lech Bishalom. Shalom means shlemus, perfection. A living person is always going towards perfection. He's always improving. There's always room for more perfection. There's always room to progress, to grow. A person who's died, that's it. He's reached his level. He's not going to reach any more on his own doing. Other people can do for him. Children can be mezakeh their parents after they leave this world, and so on. But the person himself, once he leaves this world, can't progress anymore. So we say, Lech Bishalom. Go with the perfection that you have. You're not going towards perfection. You've reached what you've reached, right? You may be able to have more perfection with other people's doing, but not with your own. So that is the second aspect of judgment. All the things as sheep, and then how does that look compared to where you were and where you're going? So what's left? A third aspect, as a soldier. What does that mean? Rav Shlaga Feivel Mendelovich says the following. In Rosh Hashanah davening, we said, Ma se'ish u'pikudaso. God judges the deeds of men, u'pikudaso, and his mission. He said what it means is the following. Each and every one of us have mitzvahs that we do like everybody else does. Right? We say Kriya Shma, and we daven, and we keep Shabbos, and we keep Yontif, and we hear the same shofar. But we also have a mission in this world. And the mission is determined by many things. It's determined by your talents, abilities, capabilities. It's determined by your circumstances, where and when you live, who you come in contact with, what circumstances present themselves to you. Put that all together, that's your part in the play. Everybody gets a costume, which is their body. They get props, which is their material possessions. They get a place on the stage, which is their place where they live and the time when they live. And they get their lines, who they have to speak to and who they have to respond to. And all these things form your mission in this world. Right? Youngsters, the seminary girls or yeshiva boys that I teach, always ask me, what's my tachlis? How do I know what my tachlis is? I said, if they expect me to pull out a script from my pocket and say, oh, listen, what was your name again? Ah, yeah, here's your tachlis. Go read it and go do it. Right? It's absurd. No time is a script going to fall out of the heavens and tell you what your tachlis is. God tells you your tachlis unfolds day by day, second by second. Your tachlis is what circumstances come your way that you can use your unique talents, abilities, capabilities, and all the circumstances that apply to you, how can you use it properly? The Shulchan Aruch tells you how to use it properly. Ask advice from people who know better than you how to use it properly. And if you face all the unique circumstances that come your way properly, that's your tachlis. That is your tafkid. Yeah? Everything. That all's included. Everything. Right? People have children, people don't have children, it's all part. I mean, chinuch, what? Tell them what their tachlis is? Yeah, yeah, that's part of a person's tachlis too. How he relates to his children, how they relate to him. That's also part of the tachlis. It's all circumstances and occurrences that putting together your unique way of responding because of who you are, when you were born or whatever, all of that goes into your tachlis. Rav Kook Zatzal said an interesting thing. We say in Yom Kippur, Elokai ad shelo notzarti eini kedai, v'achshav shenotzarti ki'ilu lo notzarti. Until I was created, it wasn't kedai. It wasn't worth it. And now that I'm here, it's like I'm not here. So Rav Kook Zatzal explained in the following way. Every person, his neshama has a purpose to serve in this world. And that purpose is meant for a certain time and a certain place. And I'll give you an example. I'll give you two examples. A Gadol B'Yisrael, let's not mention any names because it may be a little derogatory. I don't think so, but it's a good mashal. Take a Gadol, right? What's it called? Who was a Gadol in our generation, okay? If he would have lived in the time of the Nevi'im, Tanoim, Amoraim, he would have been nothing. Okay, he was only something special compared to the generation that he lived in. If he would have been born before his generation, he wouldn't have accomplished anything, because there would have been much greater people than him. He would have been totally negated and overshadowed. But God held that neshama to come into a world where his neshama could make an impression because of the time zone that he was in. Somebody with one kind of neshama, and had he been born in Eretz Yisrael, maybe would not have been functioned as well as he'd born in America. In America, he was somebody special, was able to do a lot. In Eretz Yisrael, he would have been lost in the crowd, and the vice versa. Somebody born in Eretz Yisrael who could make an impression because of the circumstances here, had he been born in America, wouldn't have made any impression. Maybe would have been a different person. The more personal thing, I think that the Rabbanu Shel Olam saved my neshama for a time after tape recorders were created. Because great people of past generations didn't need tape recorders to have their words remembered. They were so intense and so important, people remembered them, right? And or they remembered them in books, or they read the books. But if I would have been born in such a time, anything I said would have been forgotten immediately. So the Rabbanu Shem had Rachmanis, and he said, I'm going to bring you in the world when there are tape recorders, so somebody remember what you said, because it's on tape. So that's what it means. Ad shelo notzarti eini kedai. If you would have brought me into the world before the time came for my neshama to be able to accomplish something because of the time and the place, it wouldn't have been worth it. And now that I'm here, am I accomplishing what I'm supposed to accomplish anyway? That's the second question.
But you're lucky you know that.
I didn't say I know it, I just said it. The yeah. Ask me after Sukkot. We will eventually get to that when we get to Schar and Onish, reward and punishment, which is one of the 13 principles of faith, which is about two or three principles ahead of us. When we get to that, we'll discuss it in great detail. Mir Sashel. Now, how serious is it if you don't use your talents, abilities, capabilities, and you don't have to have phenomenal talents, capabilities, and abilities. God put you in a place where you can have an effect, even on your own family, on one other person, on a neighbor. The circumstances that come your way fit you. How bad is it if you just don't do your mission? You just do what everybody else does, and you don't use what God gave you in a positive, constructive way. So the Chiddush Harim says the following. At Ni'ilan Yom Kippur, there's no time for the long Al-Chait. So we skip it. We don't say it. Instead, we say a bunch of paragraphs that start Atanosen Yad Laposhim. In those paragraphs, there's one confession, one sin. L'man nechdal me'oshek yodenu. In order that we should stop stealing. Says the Chiddush Harim, all Jews are ganofim. That's the one sin that every single Jew, men, women, children, have to say Ni'ilah Yom Kippur, we should stop stealing? What does it mean? So he says the following. I'll give you an example, and then I'll tell you what he says. In secular high schools, what I'm familiar with in the States, aside from scouts from athletic teams that they send to the senior class to see if they have any super sports stars that they would like to recruit for their basketball or football team, firms also send scouts to look for young, fresh talent. For instance, an engineering architecture firm will send a scout to the senior class looking for students that excel in mathematics and in art. Put those two things together, you have a great architect or engineer. Okay, somebody who has those talents. So they find one student that really is really talented in both these areas, and they say, you would make a great architect or engineer. If you're interested in going to college and learning architecture or engineering, we are interested in paying for your tuition, giving you room and board and spending money, with one condition, that when you get your degree, you come and work for our firm for 5 years. That way we guarantee young, fresh, new talent, and we think that you have the potential to really be an excellent engineer or architect. Person says, sounds great, right? Get my whole education paid for with a guaranteed job. What could be better? They sign on the dotted line. They go through college and they taka become an architect or an engineer. And then they come to work for the firm. But instead of doing anything constructive, they doodle all day. That's it. Okay? What sin are they guilty of? Geneva. They are robbers because all that money was invested in them with the intent that they give a return on the investment. And they're not giving any return. They've stole all that money. Similarly, says the Chiddush Harim, God has invested in us a lot more than money. He gave us a body, a neshama. He gave us talents, abilities, capabilities. And he expects us to use that all in his service. Now we come to Elah and we look back over the year and we see that not only haven't we been using all of that for God's service many times, we've been using it for the competition many times. So we are ganofim. We have stole all those things that God invested because we're not giving him a return on this investment. So we tell God this year we realize that we were ganofim. This coming year we promise you we'll start giving you a return on your investment. Will stop being ganavi. So that is the third aspect of judgment. The third aspect is that you're going to be judged as sheep, how good you were, mitzvahs, midos, emunos, and if you live a Jewish lifestyle, and you're also going to be judged as climbers, are you progressing or regressing, and then you're going to be judged on the third aspect, are you a good soldier? Are you fulfilling your unique mission using your talents, your abilities, your capabilities, your unique circumstances in this world to their fullest advantage in service of Hashem? That is the three aspects of judgment. So that's it. And we have 15 minutes left. What am I going to do? What?
What have you accomplished as
Osher? As? Okay. Yeah. Right. That's Reb Zusha. Okay, we're not finished. Hold on one second. Neither is the judgment finished. You think that's it. That's not it. Because there's four more words in the Mishnah. Aside from the Mishnah saying, Kol boy olam ovrim lefan of kivnei maron, all human beings pass before God as b'nei maron. And we said b'nei maron has in it sheep, climbers, soldiers. Then the Mishnah ends with four more words. The kulam niskarim b'skira achas. All of them are viewed with one glance. Now, what does that mean? I'll tell you what I think it means. After God judges you, us, on these three levels, that would be sufficient if we were the only person in the world. If we were the only person in the world, we could be judged as a sheep, as a climber, as a soldier. But we're not the only person in the world. We live in a world of many, many, many people. And we are not responsible to function only as individuals. We are responsible to function within the various communities that we live, starting with our family, starting with, going with our extended family, our neighborhood, our city, country, Klal Yisrael, the world. We interact with other people. We affect other people. So it's not enough for God to judge us only as individuals on these three aspects. He's going to have to judge us afterwards on a second tier, second level, on all three aspects again, but not how we were as individuals. How did we interact with everybody else? In other words, you could be a great sheep, healthy, you have God's brand, right? You're there, but you're not part of the flock. You're alone, a loner. You're a sheep on the side of the flock. You don't interact with other people. You have no connection to other people. So who cares? God cares. Because eino dome yachid oses hamitzvah l'rabim oses hamitzvah. There's no comparison, one person doing a mitzvah or a lot of people together doing a mitzvah. I'll give you an example. You could have stayed home today and listened to tapes. You could even listen to tapes of me. Right? And you could have had the same hour shiur in your house. But isn't it better that you came and interacted with other people here? Right? Isn't it better that the shiur that I would have given on that tape, if I would have given it to one person, right, would have not been the same shiur. It's a different shiur because there's so many people here, right, it makes difference in how I have to prepare or how I have to speak or whatever. I once was in a different country, speaking in a Beis Yaakov, and the policy of that Beis Yaakov was that men did not speak in front of the girls, but they wanted men to address the girls. So the man sat in an office alone downstairs, and they videoed his speech upstairs to the girls, which was an interesting experience for me, but I felt like an idiot talking to myself. And I just couldn't get into what I wanted to say. So I asked them, could you have another man at least sit in the office? I'll talk to him. But I just feel like an idiot talking to a screen. It was very nice. I have no complaint against it. There is what to say about the policy. But how in the world can you talk to yourself? Or it'd be much different. If only one of you were here, right? I don't care who it is, right? And I was talking to you, it would not be the same sheer. So your being here makes it different for everybody else. And there's no comparison of a lot of people doing a mitzvah together and one person doing a mitzvah. The same thing, Barovam Hadras Melech. Right? There's more honor to God when more people are involved. So a lot of people in a shul davening is different than a few people in a shul davening. So were you part of that minyan? Were you part of those mitzvahs? How did you function with other people in the flock? Not as a loner. You may be a beautiful sheep as an individual, but how did you fit in with other individuals? That's the second level of the first aspect of judgment. After God judges you on all three aspects, on one level as individuals, he's going to start to judge you again as part of the community. Next, that was the first level. Second level, first aspect. How about second level, second aspect? Climbers. If you'd be the only person climbing up that staircase, so God would look and see what level you're on, what level you were on last year, and he'd come to his decision of how to judge you. But there's people above you on the ladder, and there's people beneath you. How did you interact with them? You're on level 30. How did you interact with the people on 29 and below? Did you ever look back and say, would you like a helping hand to help you come up to level 30? Could I help you? Could I teach you? Could I inspire you? Could I, whatever. Did you ever show an interest in helping other people up to your level? Or did you ignore them? And even help or not help, what kind of example were you to those people? When they looked up to level 30, right, you're this frum person, you really daven and you shuckle and you're very medactic and you only eat glatt kosher, right, you're on level 30. The people on level 20, when they looked up, what did they see? Somebody that really impressed them, right, and they admired and they said, wow, we would like to be on level 30. Look what a beautiful human being you are when you're so frum and you're on level 30. Or were you the person who really shuckled, but while you were shuckling, you knocked down 10 people around you, right? And you ran to shul with great zeal and stepped on 10 people's toes, right? You used to practice your shofar blowing 2 o'clock in the morning in your apartment building, right? So you really were a real frum person on level 30, but you were a miserable human being. So when people looked up to level 30 and saw you there, they said, that's the last thing in the world I ever want to be is on level 30, because I never want to be a miserable person like that person. Were you a Kiddush Hashem? Were you a Chilul Hashem? How did you impress the people beneath you? And how about the people ahead of you? Did you look up to them and admire them and say, wow, I would like to be that frum. I would like to be a person who really controlled my tongue and didn't speak Lashon Hara like that person 10 levels ahead of me? I would like to be that person who really keeps Shabbos meticulously, that person 5 levels ahead of me? Or did you look up and you said, ah, those fanatics, chnyoks, right? Shchorim, kitzonim, whatever language you like, right? In any language, things that discourage those people, that mock them, that made them feel uncomfortable. So instead of encouraging them and strengthening them and admiring them, you did the opposite. So you're not going to only be judged on what level you've reached, but how did you interact with the people beneath you? How did you interact with the people ahead of you? That's the second level of the second aspect of judgment. And the same thing goes for the third aspect. You could do your part excellently. I love to give this example. It's something I thought of a few years ago, and it really hits the spot, I think. Imagine a play, okay, about Abraham Lincoln. Okay, I don't know why I picked Abraham Lincoln, but in any case, a play about Abraham Lincoln. It's a 4-hour play, and it traces the life of Abraham Lincoln from the moment he's born in the log cabin